You girls want to come forward? You can, you're welcome to come forward. What's in that glass?
Carriages.
And pears. That's a good combination. All right. So we're going to speak on Mahabharata. Mahabharata, great Bharata. We have Great Britain, or had. So there's Great Britain, and in the ancient times when Greek civilization spread, at one point it was called Magna Graecia. Magna. Magna is just Sanskrit Maha. So Great Greece. So Great Bharata. So I rather than just tell stories, I mean, I will tell stories. So before you demand a refund, we'll have some stories. However, I want to say something also about the historical context of Mahabharata. I want to also speak about the literary genre of the Mahabharata, how it fits into, you could say, rational or scholarly ways of categorizing different kinds of literature, the influence it had in the world, and so on and so forth, and influences that acted upon it. So, so a few introductory remarks, and we'll probably finish by the weekend. It's of course, the single event which gave rise to the Mahabharata, and upon which the Mahabharata is based and centered around, is the fact that God came to this world. Krishna came to this world. And so first I'd like to speak a little bit about the historical circumstances surrounding Krishna's decision to come to this world, and then how India, of course India is a modern word, Bharata, how ancient Bharata, how Bharata responded to the fact that God came to the world, and how this response, of course, Vyasadeva composed Mahabharata, but then once Vyasa composed Mahabharata, how did people in ancient Bharata, how did they respond to the text, and what did they do with it, so that we have what we have today? First of all, Krishna's descent. In a sense, it is a scheduled descent. In fact, there's a chapter in the second canto of the Bhagavatam which Prabhupada titled Scheduled Incarnations. So, in a very famous verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. Whenever dharma is declining and abhyutanam adharmasya, adharma is rising, tadat manam sujamiham, that I manifest myself. And Krishna, of course, says he does this paritanaya sadhunam, in order to deliver, to save, basically good people. Paritanaya sadhunam vinashaya cha duskritam, to remove bad people, evildoers, literally duskritam, and dharma sangstapanartaya, to reestablish dharma. Sambhavami yuge yuge, I come in every yuga. So, in the Dwapara age, in the Dwapara yuga, Krishna came at the very end of the Dwapara age, interestingly enough. He came at the end of the Dwapara yuga, so that the shastras always remind us that the very moment Krishna left this world, the Kali yuga began. So Krishna's departure from this world was the official beginning for the grand opening of Kali Yuga. Now, that's the general purpose of Krishna's descent. But things like dharma glani, the decline of dharma, or adharma bhutanam, the rise of adharma, they take specific historical shapes. It's not just a general thing. And so, we can actually directly trace the Mahabharata story back to the eighth canto of the Bhagavatam, something which is not always noticed, but is nonetheless a fact, because it's in the eighth canto. The eighth canto of the Bhagavatam describes a great cosmic battle between the suras and asuras, devas and daityas, and so on, the cosmic good guys and bad guys. So, interestingly, this whole incident began with various incarnations of Krishna. It began with the churning of the ocean of milk, which you probably know that story. Churning the ocean of milk. So then Krishna himself came as Kachapa Rupa, the tortoise, and held the Mandarachala, the Mandara mountain, on his back. Prabhupada said his back was itching, so he arranged to put a big mountain on his back, turn it to scratch his back. But anyway, so Krishna appeared as this Kachapa or Kurma, tortoise incarnation, and then once the nectar came out of the milk ocean, there was a dispute between the devas and daityas, demons and demigods, over the nectar, and so Krishna came again as Mohini Murti, or the Mohini, which in English sort of means the enchantress, the form as this divine enchantress. So Krishna came as Mohini Murti, bewildered the demons and gave the nectar to the gods, and then left. So he just left, and then when the demons realized what had happened, they were very unhappy and immediately declared war on the gods, and Krishna wasn't there. He had left. So, at that point, the battle broke out between the gods and the demons, and the gods were not doing that well. They were not doing that well. It's interesting because, just as Mahabharata was a war between cousin brothers, as we know, Pandavas and Kurus. Actually, they were all Kurus. But in any case, the Kurukshetra Yudha, the Battle of Kurukshetra, was a war between cousin brothers within the same dynasty. And you could say the prelude to this, which really presages it, one could say, is this battle between the cousin brothers. After all, Aditi and Diti are sisters. And therefore the Adityas and Daityas, the demigods and asuras, they're cousin brothers. So there's a sense in which the whole Mahabharata history, culminating in the Battle of Kurukshetra, was simply a repetition of something that had already happened earlier. It was a reenactment on Earth of something that had happened earlier, and why it happened on Earth I'll explain also. So, anyway, this battle broke out, the gods were not doing so well, the demons under Bali, the great Bali Maharaj, grandson of Prahlad, were sort of winning. And at that point, Vishnu appeared again, this time not as Mohini Murti, this time as just Vishnu with all his weapons ready to get down to business. And so when Vishnu appeared, the demons were kind of waiting. Now Bali himself did not attack Vishnu. Because as we know, in Vamana Leela, in the story of Vamana, it turns out that Bali actually was sort of a closet Vaishnav. And after all, his grandfather was a pure devotee, the great Prahlad Maharaj, one of the greatest Vaishnavas. So when Vishnu appeared, Bali didn't do anything. And actually, Vishnu also did not attack. This is very interesting, because often in these battles, for example, in the fourth canto, in the story of Dhruva's battle with the Yakshas, he actually didn't kill anyone until they attacked him with lethal intent force. But anyway, Vishnu did not attack it. He simply appeared there. And so the first demon to rush against Vishnu, no negotiations, nothing like, let's talk about it. A demon just immediately rushed at Vishnu and took a trident. Demons like tridents, and he threw it at the head of Garuda. So Vishnu then, Narayan, he caught this trident and just threw it back and killed the demon. Now, the point here, though, is that the name of this demon is Kalanemi. And I'll explain why it's very significant, Kalanemi. Then another demon attacked, named Viprachitti. Viprachitti is also a famous, one of the famous asuras of the Mahabharata. And what's interesting about Viprachitti and Kalanemi, well, I'll take it step by step. This leads right into the Mahabharata. The demons lost. And once Vishnu sort of tipped the scales, it was sort of like America entering World War II. Anyway, Vishnu tipped the scales and the demigods won. Now, what we can see is, if we study the history, you have to take stories in the Bhagavatam, Mahabharata, and if you look at it as a historian, put it all together, a very clear picture emerges. After the demons lost, first of all, they... Hare Krishna. The demons had a famous guru whose name in English, if you translate English, would be Professor White. And in Sanskrit, it's Shukracharya. So Professor White, Shukracharya, had all the asuras as basically as his clients. And Shukra had the power to bring his clients back to life if their bodies were not completely mutilated or pulverized. He could bring them back to life. And so he did just that. He brought the demons back to life. Now at that point, the demons actually split into different camps. And this is something which becomes clear if you study the history. Some of them, led by Bali, did not want to fight against Vishnu. Bali was anxious to fight Indra, but not Vishnu. Therefore, Bali decided that he would simply continue to fight against Indra. And eventually, of course, he conquered him. That's why Vamana came. In any case, there were other demons like Kalanemi and Viprachitti that developed a very interesting strategy, which can be explained as follows, how to counterattack. If you study the history of insurgency movements, an insurgency basically, as you know, is when, let's say there's some kind of civil war or rebellion, and let's say someone is challenging the government and wants to overthrow the government, but they fail to do so. Then what they practically always do, these failed insurgency movements, and that's exactly what the demons were, it was a failed insurgency. So what they did is the same thing that insurgents always do, and that is you find some remote place where you can regroup and eventually counterattack. Now, therefore, you find, for example, in South America, insurgents, they always go to the mountains or they go to the jungles. In North Africa, they go into the deserts. In Chechnya, another example, going to the mountains. In other words, you go to areas that are geographically or topographically inaccessible or very difficult where your enemies cannot bring a conventional army or find you, for that matter. And so what's very interesting is that the same pattern of sort of insurgents regrouping is exactly what led to the Mahabharata story. So as I said, Bali Maharaj, he decided just to continue his battle on the celestial realm, in the celestial realm against Indra, not to fight Vishnu. But Kalanemi, who really didn't like Vishnu, remember, he was the first one to attack him. And Viprachitti, they decided that they would find some remote part of the universe where they could regroup. And that, in fact, they would take over a sort of a minor, out of the way, out in the middle of nowhere planet. And if you know your Star Wars, turn it into a type of Death Star and use it as a base to counterattack. They also were very clever because they realized that George Lucas basically got the idea of the Force from this ancient Vedic culture. And the Force is actually Dharma. There are statements, for example, in Mahabharata, George Lucas, he studied world mythology with Joseph Campbell and all that. Anyway, there's a statement, for example, that Dharma... rakshito rakshati. When Dharma is protected, it protects. And hingsita hingsati. When it is injured, Dharma injures. So therefore, the demons, these asuras, were sort of, there was a method to their madness. And they realized that the only chance they had to get away with this was that they could not grossly violate Dharma, because if they did, it would trigger this reaction, this cosmic force of Dharma. And so therefore, in this remote planet they decided to take over, they decided they would actually take birth by their power in royal families, so that according to Dharma, they could take over the planet. They would actually become the rulers of the planet, and according to Kshatriya Dharma, they could attack other Kshatriyas. They also took birth as wild animals, so that according to Pashu Dharma, or the Dharma of animals, they could actually, in the forests, they could kill sages and not violate Dharma. So this, by the way, this is all explained in the Mahabharata if you read the Sanskrit text. It's not always in the comic books or the movies. Anyway, so the planet they chose was this one. This is the planet that the failed insurgency chose to take over and turn into a Death Star to counterattack the gods. And they began coming down. They began coming down to this world. And, for example, Kalanemi, this very bad-tempered demon, took birth in this world as Kansa. And he took birth in the Yadu dynasty, which was one of the great military dynasties, of course, of the world at that time. And he eventually took over the Yadu dynasty, as we know. And Viprachiti came down. He took his birth in what was then, back then, called Magadha, and became Jarasandha. Now, if you've read the Krishna book or the Bhagavatam, Bhumi Devi went to Brahma to seek help because the earth was being taken over by these asuras from higher planets. And that's why Bhumi actually went to Brahma, because as the earth goddess, she was overpowered. It's like, for example, imagine if let's say, like, Hell's Angels or something just drive into some little town in Missouri and take over the town. The sheriff can't do anything, so they call the National Guard or something. So that was a situation. Bhumi was simply overwhelmed because the asuras from higher planets, after all, they're sons of Aditi, of Diti, Daityas, they were taking over the earth. So, they of course, you know the story that Bhumi went to Brahma. Brahma took Bhumi and all the demigods, and they went to the shore of the Milk Ocean, and they received the message from Vishnu that I'm going to come myself, and Yadushupa Janyatam, that you should take birth in the Yadu dynasty with your wives. Now, the demigods actually appeared through expansions. That's why Kunti, for example, had five sons with five demigods. Actually, four demigods. Not Kunti. Kunti had three sons with three demigods, and then Madri got two for the price of one with the Ashwins. So that's the basic context, historical context. Now, Mahabharata really takes place at three different levels. On the one hand, it's a story of a dynastic struggle on earth. You know, the Kuru dynasty, the Pandavas, and so on. So on the one hand, it's just earthly history. It's the history of great kings on earth many thousands of years ago. But on the other hand, or on a higher level, it's actually a cosmic story. Because the earth is the battleground, just like, for example, if you study World War I or World War II, there may have been specific battlegrounds, but still was a world war being fought out in certain theaters, in certain areas. And so in the same way, the battle was being fought on Earth, but the stakes were the universe. So it was actually a universal struggle. And ultimately, on the highest level, it's really Krishna Lila. It's just Krishna coming to this world to reveal perfect spiritual knowledge. So therefore, the three levels of the Mahabharata are Bhoma, or you could say Swargya, and Adhyatmika. It takes place on the earthly level, celestial level or cosmic level and spiritual level. So that's the background. The next topic, perhaps, is the Mahabharata as a text. What is it as a book? Of course, now the one key fact which you have to keep in mind is that we often hear people say incorrectly that Vyasadeva wrote the Mahabharata. This is incorrect because people didn't write things back then. There's no evidence of writing. The verb in the Bhagavatam that's always used to describe what Vyasadeva did is the verb kri. Karoti, one does, like krita, and so on. Or karanam, all these words. And we still have that word in English, by the way. Kri, this verbal root, which is the English word create. And also, like the word increase, that's all from the Sanskrit root. So Vyasadeva composed it. He composed the Mahabharata, but it was an oral composition, not a written composition. There's actually no mention anywhere in the Bhagavatam or the Mahabharata of writing. The story of Vyas dictating Ganesh writing is a very, you know, wonderful Hindu legend, which is not found in the Mahabharata itself, by the way. And we have overwhelming evidence that it was an oral text. If you study, there's a whole academic field called literacy and orality, which means if you study oral cultures, it's a very different world. They have a very different concept of time. It's just they live in a different world, cultures that rely exclusively on oral communication. And that's sort of a different topic for now, that we don't have time for right now. But anyway, if you are reciting something like the Mahabharata, There are several, let's say, unmistakable signs in the Sanskrit text itself that this was an oral tradition. And again, the Mahabharata says nothing about writing. It says nothing about writing. For example, when you are reciting something, and you have to think on your feet, because it's obviously much too large a text to memorize. And so you basically just tell the story. And because let's say it's thousands of years ago, let's say it's 3,000 or 4,000 years ago, or 4,500 years ago, and you are in some village in India, because most of people live in, you know, little farming villages, and you're in some village, and people have finished their work for the day, and it's night, and the stars have come out, and you're going to recite Mahabharata, and it's like, oh my God, what was that thing? So, in order to remember what you need to say. Because the Mahabharata is mostly composed in shlokas. The word shloka comes to mean generally just a verse, but technically the shloka is a type of meter. It's a verse that has four lines of eight syllables. And that's the most common type of meter used in our literature. An example is the first verse of Bhagavad Gita. Four eight-syllable lines. Dharma kshetre kuru kshetre samaveta yuyutsava Mama ka pandavaschaiva kim akurvata sanjaya. Four eight-syllable lines. So what we find throughout the Mahabharata is a sort of little stock eight-syllable things you could just insert. Like when you needed to think, you just stuck in an eight-syllable off-the-shelf thing. And therefore you have, like one for example, is Pandavo Bharatarshava. Pandava, the best of the Bharatas. So Pandavo Bharatarshava is eight syllables. And then there's many like this. And so when you're writing something, you vary the language. You use different phrases. You know, you get out your thesaurus. But in oral traditions really depend upon a lot of repetition. Also, and another evidence of an oral tradition, besides these sort of like, very formulaic, repetitive type things, which you do find in the Mahabharata. Another thing is that the Mahabharata was recited all over Bharatvarsha, and of course it's a very large area, especially before modern technology, and therefore you have different versions of it all over India. again, it's the same story. It's basically this. I mean, it's obviously the same book, but there are many variations. So that and these variations, because that's typical oral recitation. I'm going to give you a few examples of this. I'll give you a few examples of regional variations in the text. I forget where I was. I'm traveling so much. I can't remember where I talked about this, but I was somewhere just a few days ago. Lawrence. For example, there's a verse which is often quoted. It's often quoted in ISKCON. Of what you should do if your guru has serious spiritual problems and it looks like he's down for the count. Because, you know, there was a time, not now, because now we've sort of learned how to do these things in the early days of the movement, as sociology would have predicted. It's, you know, there's that difficult period where someone like Prabhupada leaves and you have to figure out how to do things. But at a time when it was an issue, now it's not so much of an issue, the GBC wrote a paper. I personally handled the Sanskrit for the paper. And one of the main verses we quoted was that Gurorapi avaliptasya, even a guru, avaliptasya, who has become contaminated, karya karya majanataha, not knowing right from wrong, utpata pratipanasya, who has taken to the wrong path, utpata pratipanasya, Parityago vidhiyate, the rule is that you should give him up. I mean, if you have a guru that, for example, is no longer a Vaishnava, or doesn't accept Krishna, or has become, you know, sinful, and so on and so forth, obviously, that person no longer can serve as a guru. And this is common sense. It's just like nowadays, there's this big controversy because there were priests who were abusing children and somehow got to remain priests. And people are realizing this is absurd. So anyway, but what's interesting here is that if you look at all the different versions of the Mahabharata, and again, it's the same book, it's not a different book, but there are variations. And basically these vary, because when you write things down, that's kind of it. Like, you can't change Shakespeare now, because people say, wait a second, that's not Shakespeare, look. So once you write something down, everyone knows what it is. But when it's only oral, then go for it. So roughly, though, the different, what are technically called recensions, different versions of the Mahabharata, are North India and South India, which is no surprise. And what's interesting is that, as we know, South India is, so to speak, the buckle on the Veda belt. You know, they talk about the deep south like the buckle on the Bible belt, so South India, with all their Brahmins, was the buckle on the Veda belt. And basically for the same historical geographic reasons, more conservative than the North. North India was much more in contact with other civilizations. South India was, you know, basically their neighbors were fish. You know, and so for all the same reasons. I mean, for example, the Northeast United States was in touch with Europe, and the West Coast, or the Left Coast, was always in touch with Asia. And so it's the middle part that's kind of, you know, the heartland. So in the same way, in South India, they're more conservative. So in the South Indian Mahabharata, you have the same verse, Gurorapyavaliptasya, even a guru if he's contaminated, Karya Karya Majanata. By the way, this was, Bhishma spoke this verse to Parashuram, just before they started their battle, because Parashuram was Bhishma's guru. So Bhishma says, even a guru, if he's contaminated, not knowing right from wrong, has taken to the wrong path. But in the South Indian Mahabharata, the last line is exactly the opposite. You should still follow him, because he's the authority. So you see this conservatism. They changed the last line because you just couldn't say, give up a guru in South India. It was too conservative. Now, in this case, not in every case, but in this case, it seems the North Indian version is more to the point, because Bhishma is justifying the fact he's about to fight his guru. Because Parashuram wanted Bhishma to marry Amba. It's interesting. Amba, Ambika, and Ambalika, which means, you know, it's like, it's like Amba, little Amba, and little bitty Amba. You know, Amba, Ambika, Ambalika. If you know Spanish, like Amba, Ambita, Ambitita. So, Anyway, so that's an example of a cultural difference between North and South India. Or another example which shows, again, the conservatism of South India. Vyasadeva. Now, in the counterattack against this demonic invasion of Earth, the first wave, so to speak, the first avatar to come down was Vyasadeva, sort of preparing the way. And so, in the North Indian version, it's very simple that Satyavati is this beautiful, very beautiful young girl, and she's in this fishing community for various reasons, which that's a whole other story, what she's doing there. But anyway, so she, in order to help her father, who's a fisherman, you know, bring in a few more ancient rupees, she rows this little boat back and forth across the Jamuna River. So the great sage Parashara, not Parashuram, but Parashara Muni, this primeval Vedic sage, wants to cross the river, and he sees her, and she's really beautiful. And basically he tells her, let's just do it. And she's kind of, you can't be serious. Anyway, but eventually they agree. And here's a case where I think the original story has actually been lost. Because Parashara Muni is a great sage, Satyavati is the mother of an incarnation, so it's not just a question. And so the North Indian version simply says, such a kama tam, he desired her. And of course they went to an island in the river, the word for island is dwipa, and they had a child, so therefore who was called sort of like the island boy, which in Sanskrit is dvaipayana. So, anyway, I think the North Indian version has also kind of already been changed a bit, and I'll give evidence for that. But now, if you're a reciter, if you're traveling around India thousands of years ago, and that's what you do for a living, and you're reciting Mahabharata, and you go down to South India and tell this story, and they almost, they almost string you up, hang you from a tree. Because they don't want to hear that an avatar, Vyasadeva, Veda Vyasa himself, was born out of wedlock. And so you actually cannot... It's just like even in America, there are certain things you can't publicly perform. I mean, there are some rules. So in southern India, in ancient southern India, you simply could not say that. The people just would not allow you. I mean, you might actually even be in trouble yourself. Therefore, what we find is, in the South Indian Mahabharata, in fact, Parashara Muni and Satyavati get married. They have this huge Vedic wedding, Vedic/Hindu wedding, and the whole cosmic village turns out. Sometimes they talk about the global village. Well, the Vedic scriptures talk about what is basically a cosmic village. People know each other. The great sages, the demigods, even the asuras, the gandharvas, they all know each other. So it's like a cosmic village. So the whole cosmic village comes out for the wedding, and they get married, and then they beget Vyasadeva. So that's another example. There are other examples. For example, there were certain kingdoms in India at different times that were ruled by Shaiva kings, and at certain times there was sort of a sectarian tension. And therefore, if you wanted to recite Mahabharata in that kingdom, you had to put in a chapter glorifying Mahadev. Otherwise, don't tell, you can't recite in my kingdom. So there's all kinds of things going on. And it's like, for example, just like nowadays, there's paid advertising. If a show is really popular, all the big corporations want to advertise. And so basically what happened is, that because Mahabharata became wildly popular in the ancient world, and even outside of India, it was like the super story. It was like basically like Star Wars, The Avatar, Lord of the Rings, and everything put together. And so, again, this is, people back then, did not even have cell phones. They couldn't even text message. There were no movies. There were no movies. There was no television. So even if you go back in the 19th century, if you go back 150 years, say the works of Charles Dickens were serialized because that was the television of the time. Books like Oliver Twist or other great novels by Charles Dickens, they would come out like every month. They would come out a new edition. And that's why even in those books you see a lot of repetition, because it was serialized. So the Mahabharata, that was the summer blockbusters. That was television. That was the movies. That was the 3D. It was everything. That was IMAX. So therefore, all kinds of Brahmins who had political power and cultural power, they wanted to advertise. So therefore, they start putting in all their views on things. So that when Bhishma's on his... Now, before you think that I'm just being somehow irreverent or, as we say in ISKCON, concocting something, the authority for this view that the Mahabharata actually is filled with historical corruptions, first of all, because it was an oral text, it was an oral text, it was unstable, it could change in different ways. The authority for this is one of the greatest Vaishnavacharyas, Sripad Madhvacharya, from Southwest India. In fact, Madhvacharya wrote a book on Mahabharata called Mahabharata Tatparya Nirnaya, figuring out what the Mahabharata means. And so, in this book, I guess he wrote about, approximately 800 years ago, whatever the date is, Madhvacharya says that the text is thoroughly corrupted. The text has been thoroughly corrupted over time. This is Madhvacharya speaking. So, as they say, don't kill the messenger. And if you read the whole thing, it's obvious. Because if you take Bhagavad Gita, which is obviously the Siddhanta, the philosophical conclusion of the text, it constantly disagrees with other parts of the story in terms of what people are speaking. Whereas, in fact, the whole text should agree with the Bhagavad Gita. And there's so many repetitions, and you can actually trace different layers of Indian cultural history in the text, because people would tell it their own way. For example, India went through a Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry phase about 2,000 years ago. And, it's like, go ahead, punk, make my day. And, oh, anyway, that's a movie. Clint Eastwood's an actor. And so there was a certain point in the history where it was considered really cool for Kshatriyas to be kind of really rough and just very heavy and smash each other and without any... So you can see that reflected in certain parts of the text. Like, for example, there's one... Anyway, I mean, I can give so many examples in the text, but it goes on and on and on. And there was a time in Indian history when there was a type of fatalism. Like, so you have Duryodhana saying, what is the use of Purushakara, human action, human endeavor, when actually everything is dive, everything is fate? And if you study the Mahabharata, even... Now, the good news here is that we know the real story, basically, because we have the Bhagavatam. And Lord Chaitanya... And that's why the Bhagavatam was composed, by the way. Because even 5,000 years ago, if you know the Bhagavatam, the first canto, after Vyasadeva composed Mahabharata, he was unhappy because he didn't sort of tell it straight, so to speak, Krishna consciousness. And his guru Narada Muni came to him. Now, if you look at the Sanskrit, when Narada Muni first comes to speak to Vyasadeva, the first thing he says is quite sarcastic: are you satisfied in the bodily concept of life? Because you've given so many mundane instructions. And then he says a very, even a heavier thing. Narada is right in the Bhagavatam, you can look it up. Narada Muni says, Jugupsitang dharma kritenu shasata subhavaraktasya mahan vyatikramaha. And that, what is that then? The dharmiti manyate tasya nivaranangana. I forgot just the two or three words dropped out of the memory bank there for a second. But what Narada Muni said was, Jugupsitam. Look it up in a Sanskrit dictionary. Jugupsitam means abominable, terrible. Very heavy word, disgusting. I mean, anyway, there are a lot of heavy synonyms. This is the word Narada used. What has been done for the sake of Dharma is actually terrible. And then he calls it Mahan Vyatikrama, a great transgression. Now, because the Mahabharata, if you read the Mahabharata, the unabridged text, which no one ever does, But if you read the whole Mahabharata, I mean, everyone just wants to go to Swarga. Everybody, I mean, no one really has a serious ambition to go to the spiritual world. Everyone wants to go to Swarga. So, therefore, Narada Muni said, now you have to correct this. Tell the real story. Tell what really happened. And then Vyasadeva went into trance, samadhi, and composed the Bhagavatam. And what's interesting is that when Vyasadeva goes into his samadhi and begins to compose the Bhagavatam, almost at the beginning he goes back to the Mahabharata to tell what really happened. And therefore one of the first things, right there in chapter 7 of the first canto, when Vyasadeva, Narada's just left and Vyasa is composing the Mahabharata, Yadamridhe Pandava, and what is it? Pandava Sinjayanang Bireshato Bidagatingateshu Bireshato Bidagatingateshu. When on the battlefield, Yadamridhe Pandava Sinjayanang, the Pandavas and the Kurus, when almost all the warriors had gone to their destinations, Bireshato Bidagatingateshu. So what we're going to get is, we're going to get, for example, a different picture of Draupadi. We're not a bloodthirsty Draupadi, but a Draupadi that wants to release Ashwatthama, who's just killed her children. We're going to get a different look at Bhishma. A Bhishma in his prayers, who's a pure devotee of Krishna. We're going to get a different, we're going to see who Kunti really is, a pure devotee of Krishna. We're going to see who, the Pandavas, again, in that same first canto, when Arjuna comes back from Dwarka with the news that Krishna is gone, and you see the Pandavas are actually pure devotees. I mean, we always know that, but they're bhakti. So we know the basic story of the Mahabharata because it's in the Bhagavatam, and Lord Chaitanya accepted the Bhagavatam. So we know the basic story. But so many of the details in the text, as Madhvacharya pointed out, have been corrupted. And so, to give an analogy, it is Krishna, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, sent the six Goswamis to Vrindavan to excavate the holy places. Vrindavan is always Vrindavan. And the holy places were there in Vrindavan, but Vrindavan had become like an overgrown jungle. It had to be excavated. So in the same way, we have to excavate the story of what actually happened 5,000 years ago. And the story is basically as we know it, but there are certain significant differences. One thing which I find very interesting, and which I think will save the story in terms of making it popular for a world audience, because the Mahabharata is quintessentially the people's book. After all, you know, it's said that, what is that verse? Oh my God. Nishuti Gochara. That in this age people can't understand the Vedas, and the average people obviously can't understand Vedanta or this or that. So therefore, Vyasadeva specifically said, compose Mahabharata out of compassion for ordinary people, the ordinary people that are not philosophical, they have no intellectual sophistication. They're actually, well, you know what they are. I mean. So the Mahabharata is the people's book. It was not just meant for one country, it is the people's book. And my conviction is that if we can somehow excavate the original story, it will become the most important story in the world. So that's what I need to do. That's why I personally need to go away in a very lonely situation and just write, turn off my email, cell phone, and it's almost like type of suicide nowadays, but so I'll give you one example. If you look at the Mahabharata, which is epic narrative, it's an epic narration, and although the contents are different and in some ways very similar, it is as structurally or as a literary genre very much comparable to other ancient literature like the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, or the great epics of Scandinavia, or the Gilgamesh, you know, Mesopotamia, and so on. There was the same kind of literature. Just like, for example, if a devotee starts a rock band, I mean, devotees sometimes, you know, ISKCON produces many, well, the quality is sometimes whatever, but anyway. So, you know, rock is rock. Or for example, or to even take our kirtan, we play these drums and kartals. So many different groups in India, you know, use these instruments. It's not that we're the only ones that use it, especially the, like tabla. You know, mridanga is a little bit our thing, but if you look at kartals or, say, harmonium, that wonderful Vedic instrument invented in Europe 150 years ago. So if you take the harmonium, I mean, everyone, you know, all the different groups in India use harmoniums, right? You know, dizzy fingers. So it's a very popular instrument, and we also use it. Of course, we're chanting pure Vaishnav bhajans, and they're chanting other things. But still, it's the same instrument. And it may even use the same drum beats and so on and so forth. So there is a world literature, and the Mahabharata fits within a literary genre. Now, if you compare the Mahabharata to other literature, other ancient literatures, one thing comes up which I think has to be corrected. And it's one of the reasons why the Mahabharata has never really appealed to a world audience. And that is that somehow or other, in India, as they kind of worked and reworked the text and sort of made it their own, so to speak, the text is heavily, heavily dependent on curses and boons. So that ultimately, no one hardly does anything. I mean, it's like you hardly get one real battle or military contest. You know, I mean here, like, it's the most famous one, Krishna and Karna, you know, the ultimate pay-per-view battle. Here in the Mahabharata, we've been waiting for literally for decades, waiting for this great battle of Karna and Arjuna, and it turns out it's not a battle at all. Karna just implodes. It turns out that Karna is just booby-trapped with all these curses. All the curses go off, and there's not even really a fight. And then Arjuna, another thing, for some reason, again, which reflects, I think, to be honest, more the sort of the ancient Indian imagination than it does what really happened 5,000 years ago, that not a single Kuru hero is killed fairly. So it's not really a battle. It's like, it's no fun, I think, for people in general. It's not like Luke Skywalker or you know, or even the Avatar. So that, for example, Bhishma, you go down the list of Kuru generals, Bhishma, you know, Shikhandi, who is it, Arjuna hides behind Shikhandi, and that's a whole story. And then next up to bat, Drona. Ashwatthama is dead. Okay, I give up. So Drona also, so there's a trick for Bhishma, there's a trick for Drona. And then who takes over next? Karna. And he's tricked. And then even Shalya. So it just goes on and on and on like this. There's not a fair fight in the whole thing. And so what I'm saying, or boons, curses, at every moment, everything that happens is because once someone worshipped Lord Shiva and received a boon, or once someone offended a Brahmin and received a curse. And so, I mean, I'm not saying there's no such things in boons and curses. It's just a little overdone, in my humble opinion. And you don't really get, it's not like a real story. It's almost like boons and curses, it's like a battle of boons and curses rather than a real fight between people. Now, that's my own analysis, because I think that that's something that happened over time. And I think it's, again, it's not that there are no boons and curses, but, you know, it's like curry, you know, the right amount. You can't just, you know, get a big bucket of turmeric and just dump it in everything. And so, to give another example, just to give some examples of very popular stories that ultimately, if you really look at them with a critical eye, it doesn't make sense. One example of that is Arjuna's killing of Jayadratha. When Jayadratha, you know, Jayadratha was a co-conspirator in the death of Abhimanyu. So let's just take that as one example of something which is a story everyone's very attached to. Actually, after I tell these things, you may not give me those fruits I asked for. First of all, it's often said that poor Abhimanyu, just this young boy that was killed. The fact is that Abhimanyu was a fully qualified, fully certified Maharatha Kshatriya. He was a great warrior. He broke into the Kuru lines. He was killing huge numbers of people. So what were the Kurus supposed to do? He's killing thousands of people. Yeah, he's just a boy. Let him have some fun. So that's the first point. Abhimanyu was, you know, he was wreaking havoc. Second point, they say that, well, you know, everyone ganged up on him. And that was against the Kshatriya code. If there was a Kshatriya code, it lasted sort of the first 5 minutes of the battle. For example, one of the Kshatriya codes, when they first come together, you know, before the coin toss, like in a football game, and so everyone comes out, you know, the Kurus and the Pandavas, and they agree, don't attack the Sarathis, don't attack the charioteers. That lasts 5 minutes. And then everyone starts attacking charioteers. As far as ganging up is concerned, everyone does it. The Pandavas do it constantly. For example, when Bhishma was the Senapati, the general of the Kuru army, they were constantly doing that. Not only all five Pandavas against Bhishma, but they threw in Yuyudhana, also the great Yadu fighter, and a few other people, Drishtadyumna. So ganging up, where a bunch of warriors attacked one, that was done constantly by both sides. Now, when the great Abhimanyu finally lost his life there, and of course he was a demigod that had just come down also to help Krishna, Arjun hears the news, and 100% of his anger, like all of it, is directed toward one person among dozens. That's like, let's say, God forbid, someone, you know, a whole gang of maybe a dozen criminals come into a house, you know, and kill a family, and then when the person whose relatives were killed finds out about it, all he cares about is the person that guarded the door. Yeah, what about people that killed your family? I don't care about them. You know, here's a gang of dozens of people. No, all I care about is the person that guarded the door. So if you look at Jayadratha's participation in the attack on Abhimanyu, yes, he again, you know, he cashed in his Shiva boon. But again, Abhimanyu is just one person. I mean, Jayadratha is just one person. Of course, he had attacked Draupadi, so he really had it coming in that sense. But what about Duryodhana's son, who actually killed Abhimanyu? And Arjuna has no interest in that. What about all the elders that helped to tire him out? So then when Arjuna makes his vow, like, I don't care about anyone that killed my son, it's just the guy guarding the door. That's all I care about. Go figure. I mean, if you can explain that to me, be my guest. So then... And again, Arjuna, of course, can't really kill Jayadratha because he never kills anyone just normally. So therefore, Krishna has to do another trick and press the earth down. And so everything is tricks. So somehow or other, this appealed to a certain audience, you know, at a certain time in history. But again, it just... I don't think it's completely... As a historian, I would say... It doesn't sound plausible to me that that's what would really happen. That Arjuna would completely ignore. In fact, when Arjuna sets out that day hunting for Jayadratha, he actually salutes all kinds of other Kshatriyas that helped to kill his son. Sort of fakes them out and goes around them, and it's almost like a game. And just like, you know, see you later, dude. So, it's just like, no problem. You killed my son? Hey, that's not a problem. I just want to kill Jayadratha. So if we really think about these things, anyway, there's lots of other incidents like that. And so what I'm trying to do is staying within the boundaries of the Bhagavatam. I'm not just, you know, creating the Acharya Dev Purana. It's staying within the boundaries of the Bhagavatam. I'm trying to just understand what happened, or what is a plausible explanation of what actually happened. So, any questions on these points? We've covered some. Yes.
Maharaj, you mentioned that Mahabharata was not recorded in written form.
Until much later.
What about the Bhagavad Gita? Is that
Yeah, exactly. The Bhagavad Gita is sort of in its own category. The Bhagavad Gita was so important and had so much influence, and it was short enough, people actually did memorize it. And so in that sense, the Bhagavad Gita really, we do have, I think, the real Bhagavad Gita. Because it was just, it always was kind of like in its own category. People could easily memorize it back then, before their brains went dead by watching television and playing computer games. So, you know, many people memorized the Bhagavad Gita, and it was preserved.
Was that recorded by Vyasa?
It was, yeah, Prabhupada said that Vyasa gave us the Bhagavad Gita. So you could say whether Krishna actually in the battlefield spoke in these perfectly metered, you know, shlokas and so on and so forth, actually talked about, you know, different, like, food in the mode of goodness, food in the mode of passion, right there in the battlefield. But it's, but they are the teachings of Krishna. I mean, it is the teaching of Krishna, and it is given to us by Vyasadeva. So the way I put it is, we have the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna wants us to have. I mean, this is the Gita that Krishna wants us to have. And so we have it. Yes, go for it. Rahu.
Yeah.
Yes, Rahu.
Didn't you get the nectar too?
He got a drop of nectar, so when he was decapitated, he just got to be a disembodied head. Something like the Hare Krishna movement. I mean, we have all the intelligence, but we can't seem to move society. But anyway, so Rahu, you know, there's a headless society and there's a disembodied head. So Rahu became a, a disembodied head. Yes, yes.
Were the demons camped in this, the people, like any of the Asuras, the
Duryodhana? Oh, Duryodhana was. There's an amazing story. I don't know if they did it in the movie in India, in the television series, but there's an amazing story where at one point, when the Pandavas are in exile, Duryodhana wants to sort of rub it in, humiliate them even further. And so he decides to go, I think it was at that Dvaitavan or Kami, one of those forests there. And just to kind of humiliate them. And at that point, Duryodhana gets himself into a battle with the Gandharva king, and he loses the battle, and the Gandharva arrests him. And then Arjuna has to come and rescue him, because this Gandharva king is the same one that Arjuna spared many years before when the Pandavas were incognito and on their way to Draupadi Swayamvara. So Duryodhana was so proud that he literally couldn't stand it. It was just too much for him that Arjuna, whom he envied so much, had saved him. So he decided to do Prayopavesh, which means fast until death. Just sit down like a yogi and just fast until death. And so at that point, all these demons, these powerful demons, actually brought him, like his mind, they brought him to another place, another world, and reminded him, don't forget the game plan. Don't forget what you're supposed to be doing. And they kind of gave him a pep talk, and he went back to earth and decided not to kill himself. So, yes, Duryodhana was an asura.
Which one was he?
Oh, in the previous life? I forgot... Not one of the prominent ones in that battle from the 8th canto. Another example of something which is obviously not true, or at least very tongue-in-cheek, and that is in the run-up to the Kurukshetra battle, in the weeks or say a month before the battle, basically the Pandavas and the Kurus are all competing very heavily to get allies. They're sort of, you know the great kings of the world are sort of choosing sides, and there's a couple, to me, impossible stories in the text at that point. One is that Duryodhana and Arjuna both race to Dwarka to try to get Krishna's help. And it stated there in the text, and by the way, nowhere else in any Vedic literature, that whoever asks the Kshatriya first, then he'll help that person. Now, if you think about it, to give an analogy, imagine World War II. Imagine Franklin Roosevelt saying that Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Churchill, but Hitler asked me first. Yeah, what about all the evil he's doing? Yeah, but he asked me first. In other words, decisions about war and peace, the loss of life, the fate of the world, have absolutely nothing to do with morality. It's just all these cute little rules and tricks. And, well, he asked me for... I mean, Duryodhana is an asura. He came to destroy the world. He's been, you know, trying to kill pure devotees. The Pandavas are pure devotees. And Duryodhana has constantly been trying to murder them. And yet Krishna says, well, morality means nothing. Right and wrong mean nothing. It has nothing to do with warfare. It's only about these cute little rules. Like, well, you asked me first. What kind of message is that? That a kshatriya will kill and fight and war completely oblivious to right and wrong. Couldn't care less what's right and wrong. It's just some little rule there, some little technical rule. I mean, it's absurd if you think about it. And I think that's absolutely not what really happened. And then there's another one, which is, frankly, even more comical. And that is that as all the kings of the world are choosing sides, Shalya is going to join his nephews, the Madreyas, Nakula and Sahadev. You know, two of the two youngest Pandavas. And so then we get this story, which perhaps is just tongue-in-cheek, because you can't take it seriously. We get this story that Duryodhana basically sets up these little, I don't know you'd call it, like, you know, lemonade stands, or these little kind of like, you know, Holiday Inns or whatever, all along the way, all along the road that that Shalya is traveling. And then Shalya at one point says, gee whiz, you know, whoever set this up, I'd do anything for them. And then Duryodhana pops up, you rang, and says, fight on my side. Now, let's think about this story. And I think you'll see that it's actually comical. Maybe it's intended to be comical. First of all, Duryodhana is one of the most famous people in the world. He's the Kuru emperor. So what that means is that, first of all, he has to stay within earshot of Duryodhana for days at a time. A great king, Shalya, who obviously has all kinds of spies everywhere. He has bodyguards. He's a great king. Someone could try to attack him. So here he is surrounded by this huge security apparatus, and yet Duryodhana, incognito, can stay within maybe 10, 15 feet of him for days at a time, and no one knows he's there, waiting for him to say the magic words. Number two, I mean, that's ludicrous. Number two, Shalya is a king. The kings were back then, this Dwapara Yuga, they were brilliant. They were masters of diplomacy, of espionage, of strategy. Now, do you think that Duryodhana doesn't know, or Shalya wouldn't know, that someone is setting all these little, you know, convenience places up for me because they want my support? I mean, he would have to be mentally retarded not to know that. I mean, he would literally have to be clinically retarded not to know that whoever is setting these things up is trying to get my support and bribe me. Now Shalya is on his way to join forces. A world war is about to break out. He throws out this line, whoever did this, I'll give them anything. I mean, the whole thing is completely ridiculous. And the Mahabharata itself gives another version of it, which shows this is absolutely not what really happened. Because just before the battle starts, the two sides are set up, and I guess after the Bhagavad Gita is spoken, or maybe before the Gita, I can't remember, but just at that time, just before the battle, Yudhisthira suddenly, you know, puts down his weapons and walks between the armies, and one by one he approaches all the Kuru elders and asks their permission to fight. You know, give me your blessings to fight. And of course they all give it to him. Now, what's interesting is they all say the same thing. That particular scene in the Mahabharata is extremely formulaic, which means everyone, Yudhisthira says exactly the same thing, and they say the same thing in response. It's all formulas. And what's interesting is that Shalya says, as they all say, yes, you have my blessings, and actually, I'm only fighting because I was bribed. In other words, there's no story about the lemonade stands, the Holiday Inns, and all this stuff. It was just a straightforward bribe. Because Shalya thought that, you know, Duryodhana was going to win. He obviously was not a Mahabhagavat, Shalya. And somehow he didn't, or maybe he didn't realize that the Pandavas was going to win. Or for whatever reason, pursuing what he believed to be his own interest, he fought with Duryodhana. So, another example of which in ancient times must have been comic relief. I mean, I could give you, I don't know how many stories you want, but there's so many stories. The story of Umba and Bhishma, which is actually, I think, one of the great dramatic stories in the Mahabharata. I mean, eventually we make, I think, you know, like world-class movies. The Umba story is very, very powerful. A very powerful story. And by the way, Bhishma's fault there was not that he wouldn't marry Umba. That's actually sort of a misunderstanding. That's not why Umba eventually cursed him and eventually killed him as Shikhandi. The real mistake Bhishma made was he wouldn't allow Umba to marry Vichitravirya. So he actually could have saved her life. And so here we have this very powerful story of a woman who's telling the truth. She's actually telling the truth and no one will believe her. So in any case, there's the way this story, it's just like Narada Muni. If you've seen Hindu movies, for some reason known only to, not known to anybody anymore, Narada Muni's become kind of like this clown figure in Hindu movies. Now Narada Muni, as we know, is not a clown at all. He's actually the great sage Narada. But somehow in the Hindu imagination, he became a clown. And so you can see how these ahistorical, inaccurate stereotypes just sort of caught on. And that's what it's like, and everybody just sort of went with it. Narada the clown, Krishna the trickster. So that Krishna never does anything without a bunch of tricks. He never just does anything. There's always, Krishna's always winking and tricking and lying, and then that's Krishna. So it's Narada the clown, Krishna the sort of the serial trickster. And then another one of these is, and so the Umba story also kind of somehow fell into a type of... So here are some problems with the Umba story, which don't make sense to me. I mean, it's a very powerful story. I think it's one of the best stories in the Mahabharata. But here are some of the problems. Number one, according to Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Jang jang vapi smaran bhava tyajityante kalevaram." Whatever you remember at the time of death, that's where you go. Now, as we know, Umba thought of nothing but Bhishma. So why did she take birth as a woman again? In fact, according to the Mahabharata, it's an amazing story. When Umba finally achieves her perfection and the boon she wants, to get a boon from Lord Shiva, she throws herself into this brahminical fire, and her last words before she gives up her body are Bhishmasya Vadaya, to the death of Bhishma. Those are her last words, to the death of Bhishma. Heavy lady. So, to why she take birth as a woman? It just makes no sense. And then gets changed into... And so then there's this really farcical story in the Mahabharata, which, again, these narrations, this was the television, this was comedy, this was mystery, this was, you know, everything. It was everything for them, for the people back then. So what happens is that, King Drupada prays for a son. That reminds me of another story, which obviously... I'll just tell one more after this, and then you can eat. Another story is that... Drupada wants a son. You know, it's that putra loba of the kings. You know, they're always hankering for sons. And so when he finds out it's a girl, he's like really disappointed. And maybe his wife doesn't tell him. I mean, it's some totally implausible story. It's on the same level as, you know, like Buddha didn't really know there was birth and death in the world. You know, he was a grown man with children, didn't know that. Anyway, so Drupada decides to marry his what he thinks is his son. And so he arranges a marriage with a neighboring king. The king, and this king is very bad tempered. King sends his son, and then discovers that. No, sends his daughter. I'm sorry. The king sends his daughter to marry what he thinks is Jupiter's son. So the king sends his daughter, and then on their wedding night, her husband reveals, actually, I'm not a guy. So at that point, the king, the father of the daughter, goes crazy and attacks Jupiter's city and literally chases him all around the city. It's like this farcical. It really is. It's like slapstick. Chases him all over the city, and finally Jupiter, who in this version is sort of like this cowering, he's a coward, and he takes shelter with his wife. He sort of literally hides behind his wife's skirts. And finally they work it out, and then what happens is that anyway, there's this whole other fable where Shikhandini goes out and takes the masculinity from some other yaksha. There's a whole wild story. But what's interesting here is that Drupada, everywhere else in the Mahabharata, is one of the most powerful warriors in the world. A personal friend of Pandu. And here in this story, he literally hides behind his wife, can't even beat some insignificant king that you've never heard of before. And so you have a characterization of Drupada which has absolutely nothing to do with the real Drupada. It's just a farcical story. And one last story I want to tell, because it's obviously doesn't make sense, is the famous, is again with Drupada, that when Drupada and Drona were little kids in school, classmates, and Drupada said, "When I grow up, I'll share whatever I have with you." And then at a certain point, poor Drona. Drona is this poor Brahmin. He has this darling little son, Ashwatthama. And he can't afford to buy milk. There's even one version of the Mahabharata, one of the versions says he couldn't even get milk. And little Ashwi, Ashwatthama would say to his parents, "I want milk like all the other kids." And they would say, "Oh, I'm sorry, we're so poor, we can't buy milk." So he goes to Drupada. You've heard this story, haven't you? He goes to Drupada's kingdom. He gets rebuffed in a very rude way. And that's it. I'll get my revenge. Now, let's look at the real facts. I think I can demonstrate irrefutably this story is absurd and didn't really happen. If you just think about it logically. First of all, Drona married Kripi, who unfortunately American devotees say creepy. But actually, her name in Sanskrit is Kripi. So, who is Kripi? Well, the sister of Kripacharya, and the goddaughter, the foster daughter of the emperor of the world. Her foster father was Shantanu. That means that Drona married into the richest family on earth. Not only could Drona not afford a carton of milk for his kid, not only is that not true that he couldn't afford a little milk for his kid, he married into the richest family on earth. Kripa, his brother-in-law, Kripacharya, had his palace in Hastinapur, and Drona had his palace too. In fact, when Drona is, quote-unquote, rebuffed by Drupada, what does he do? He goes right to Hastinapur. And there's that amazing story where the kids, the princes lost their ball down in a well, and he gets it out. And they ask him, "Who are you?" And he says, "Go ask your grandfather, Bhishma, Pitama Bhishma, he knows me." And they do, and he says, "Oh yeah, that's Drona." And so what happens? All Drona has to do is show up in Hastinapur. He just has to show up, and he gets his palace. He becomes the principal of the Royal Military College and lives like a king, even though he's a brahmana. He lives like a king. All he had to do was show up. So this story about the poor Drona is, I'm quite sure that didn't really happen the way it's told. Now, here's another, I think it's an example of Brahmin narrators always putting the Brahmin over the Kshatriya. And Drupada is a Vaishnava. Drupada is a very close friend of Pandu. Pandu, who is often not known as well as he should be, is actually Pandu is one of my favorite characters in the Mahabharata. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's said that of all the millions and millions of pure devotees that came with Lord Chaitanya to this world, in Jagannath Puri, 10 of them, I think it was the number is 10, were actually the greatest, the most intimate associates of Lord Chaitanya. One of them was Ramananda Roy, another one was his father, Bhavananda Roy. Lord Chaitanya personally embraced Bhavananda Roy and said, in your last life, you were Pandu. So Pandu is not only a devotee, he's one of the greatest devotees in the universe. And his intimate friend was Drupada. So this whole story, as you can see, there's no such thing as the poor Drona. There's no poor Drona. There's no needy Drona. And what really we're dealing with here is an attempt by Drona, who never was quite content as a Brahmin. I mean, even in the battle of Kurukshetra, Bhima was saying, "What are you doing on the battlefield? Our whole lives, we offered you all the respect of a Brahmin. Now you want to come and fight." So Drona, who never really lived as a Brahmin, he basically just wanted to steal half of Drupada's kingdom. And Drupada, knowing very intelligently that Drona was on the wrong side, he was with Duryodhana, and remembering what this is all about, really, fighting for the universe, said no. Because Drupada came to this world to fight for the demigods and for Krishna, and Drona fought on the wrong side. And therefore, Drupada was not going to give him half his kingdom. And that's what it's really about. So, anyway, there is a real story which I think will actually become the most popular story in the world. And so that's what I'm praying to Prabhupada and Krishna to get this mercy to be able to tell what I believe is the real story and within the parameters of the Bhagavatam, so that I have my, I can't go too crazy because I'm staying within the boundaries of the Bhagavatam. Yes?
Maharaj, you mentioned about Kalanemi.
Yes.
Who descended to
became became Kamsa. Yes.
But there is another story where it is said that Jay and Vijay, the two gods of
yes.
Vishnu, they were cursed by the four Kumaras.
Actually, but that doesn't. But yeah, but they're not Kamsa. That in Krishna Leela, that was Vidurata, and who's the other one? And Shishupala. And
Dantavakra.
Yeah, perhaps Dantavakra. Yeah, Shishupala. So Kansa is not one of Jaya and Vijaya. Yes.
Maharaj, I'm after hearing your discussion today, seems like a powerful presentation from your side to, at least for me, question our, if you want to call them blind faith in the Mahabharata teachings.
Well, Madhvacharya wrote a book just to correct it.
Right. My thoughts are going to Srila Prabhupada's and teachings from Mahabharata himself, and where is, or which version of Mahabharata did Prabhupada himself...
That's a very interesting question. Yeah, that's a hermeneutical question. And if we study Prabhupada's approach to Shastra, it's very clear that his overriding concern was Siddhanta, to get the right philosophy, and Rasa, and so on. Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta, actually, have a, you could call, a non-literal translation style, as we know. I mean, if you look at Prabhupada's books, you can find hundreds of thousands of English words for which there's no direct Sanskrit equivalent. Because Prabhupada even said that. He said, I'm giving the purport in the translation. Prabhupada said that. And so, if you look at, and actually what Prabhupada is doing is traditional. Because even in the Bhagavatam itself, in the first canto, Sutta Goswami says to the sages headed by Shonaka, that I heard from Shuka, and now I'm going to tell you what I heard, yathadhitam yathamati, which means yathadhitam, literally, according to the reading, and yathamati, according to my realization. So what Prabhupada did, he even said this. He said he put some of the purport into the translation. So what this means is that Prabhupada is really not that concerned with all these external historical details. He was concerned with the philosophy. I mean, he sometimes is tongue-in-cheek. For example, in the seventh canto, when in the prayers of Prahlad Maharaj, where Prahlad says that the sense of hearing pulls the mind away from Krishna, Prabhupada translates the word shravanam there, hearing, as cinema songs. Now, does Prabhupada really believe that millions of years ago on a different planet, Prahlad Maharaj said cinema songs? Which is obviously, it's a very Indian term, cinema songs. And it's, they didn't say cinema songs in other planets back then. So where Prabhupada says in the Krishna book that when Krishna manifested himself as Govardhan and gave a menu to the residents, you know, for a feast, that he ordered them to make halava. Halava is an Arabic word. Halava is an Arabic word. And yet, because Prabhupada's a pure devotee, if he sees Krishna eating halava, Krishna is eating halava. Because the pure devotee is present, Krishna is present in the mind of a pure devotee. So it's what I call transhistorical. In other words, whatever a pure devotee sees, because they're seeing Krishna, Krishna's really doing that. It wasn't exactly necessarily what happened 5,000 years ago. I mean, you see this in the Acharya commentaries. So the Acharyas, they're not there. They simply have other concerns. It's not like post-Newtonian, quote-unquote, scientific historiography. They just don't. That's not in ancient cultures, whether it's Greece or Rome or India. That's just not what they use history for. History was used to teach wisdom.
Would he tell stories from the Mahabharata, though?
Yes, he might. But Prabhupada even said that if the Siddhanta and Rasa were correct, there was had the right philosophy and taught the right mood of love of Krishna, then Prabhupada would tell the stories. I mean, but you see that, again, it's not that it's not true, it's just that it may not have happened 5,000 years ago. And to give an example, there's a book, Shiva Ramaswamy produced a book called Krishna Sangati, in which he, from Prabhupada's Bhagavatam, and from commentaries by great acharyas like Vishwanath, he tells all these stories. Now, there are many anachronisms which come from the acharyas. For example, in these stories, there's so many letters going back and forth, they almost need a postal service in Vrindavan. In the sense, you know, Krishna wrote a letter to the gopis, and they wrote a letter back. Radharani got that letter, and she wrote this letter. The only problem is, they didn't write letters back then, 5,000 years ago. There's absolutely no evidence of that. And there's no mention in the scriptures of writing letters. Or they have these little cute pastimes where they argue over land deeds. Land deeds? 5,000 years ago? I mean, there's all kinds of anachronisms. So basically, like Prabhupada, when Prabhupada says Krishna eats halava, the Sanskrit word just says wheat preparation. He's just because he's seeing Krishna, and Krishna's reciprocating him. So when the pure devotees appear at a certain time and they see Krishna a certain way, and Krishna reciprocates with them, so it's not that it's not true. It's not that it's not happening, but it's not necessarily happening 5,000 years ago. It's like when Prabhupada says that Prahlad Maharaj says, "Don't listen to cinema songs." I mean, in a sense, Prahlad is saying it in an eternal realm. Prahlad is saying it. It just might not have said it back then. And Prabhupada just doesn't treat the text as the way we would treat, let's say, like the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution of India, like some, you know, ancient thing like this. These are the exact words. Because he doesn't translate literally often. Often many Sanskrit words go untranslated. He'll put in all kinds of things. He's just not dealing with it, you understand, in an academic way. But the philosophy is perfect. The philosophy is perfect, and you get love of Krishna. Because Prabhupada's purpose is to bring you back to Godhead. And he does that. He actually takes us back to Godhead. He actually liberates us and enlightens us.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Sure.
So, we're very fortunate. Prabhupada has given us Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. He asked us to take shelter of these two texts primarily and not so much worry about other scriptures. Yet your endeavor is to bring out the real story.
Well,
5,000 years ago, so I'm wondering.
Well, my endeavor really is just try to bring people to Prabhupada. And that's really my endeavor. Because ultimately...
You should distribute his books.
What's that?
Distribute Prabhupada's books. He says everything we need to know is in his books.
However, I think
with
that...
all this detailed knowledge, what does it really... Does it
because Prabhupada wrote me a letter. I'll give you two letters from Prabhupada that he wrote to me, where Prabhupada has a different attitude than what you just said. Prabhupada, for example, wrote...
I know what Prabhupada said, Mara, distribute his books.
No, but
everything we need to know...
No, but I'm telling you what Prabhupada wrote to me. Prabhupada, for example, wrote to me and said, read my books and explain them in your own words.
He also said Krishna personally told him what to say. So
the idea that...
The books are not ordinary in any stretch of
imagination. I said the books are enlightening us and bringing us back to Krishna. I just said that.
So what's the use of all this other detailed knowledge? I'm just asking a question.
Why? Because at the present time, the Hare Krishna movement is not really having much effect in this country. That's why. And Prabhupada himself, for example, when I the first letter I ever wrote to Prabhupada, the first letter in 1969, I asked Prabhupada whether I should drop out of college in Berkeley or stay. And Prabhupada said to me, stay in school. I want you to be nicely educated so that you can preach to similarly educated people. Prabhupada didn't say to me, just read my books. He told me, he said, you should be educated. For example, if you look in the Veda base, that, you know, we have all of Prabhupada's quotes, if you type in Los Angeles, what you'll find is that practically, I mean, the two main things Prabhupada says about Los Angeles in all the years he was preaching are, number one, it's got really good weather, and number two, that the scientist, Sarup Damodar, joined. Prabhupada was euphoric. He was just, if you look in the Veda base, you see Prabhupada everywhere he goes in the world talking about this, that now, he didn't tell Sarup Damodar to drop out of school. He was ecstatic about the fact that now a scientist disciple could preach to scientists. He thought that was wonderful. And Prabhupada told me, read my books and explain them in your own words. I'm not saying not just read Prabhupada's books, but... I think Prabhupada, the idea that, you know, what will our preaching do? We can't do anything, just give out the books.
Well, every letter is distribute my book, just save the world. It'll change the consciousness of the people. My books, Prabhupada said, letter after letter after letter. So I don't understand what all this detailed knowledge, how it will help in any way.
Because
there's a flaw here in the Mahabharata and the flaw... Ooh. You know, we're concerned with Lord Chaitanya, Bhagavad Gita.
I'm not... My
scriptures Prabhupada gave us.
Okay. The simple fact is that the Hare Krishna movement in this country, after distributing huge numbers of books, is a very forgotten thing. I'll give you an example.
No, but Maharaj, there's a subtle thing in people's hearts. Prabhupada said it's not that everybody will become Hare Krishna.
I'll give you an example.
You change the hearts of people to more of a spiritual awakening.
I'll give you an example.
Just by distributing books.
I'll give you an example. A devotee. I'm not against book distribution. But Prabhupada personally told me to explain his books in my own words. He personally ordered me to do that, and I'm carrying out his order. I'll give you an example. A devotee who's the head of our center in Tallahassee, Florida, gave a lecture recently in a world religion class at Florida State University, where we actually have a prasadam program. And before the class, he asked everyone in the class, you know, class, undergraduate class, has anyone here heard of the Hare Krishna movement? No one. No one had heard of it. This is at Florida State University, where we've had a center for some time. So the idea that again, based on the instructions that Prabhupada has given me, letters he has personally written to me. You know, it's very interesting what you're saying. So I'll give you an example of how sometimes devotees, you know, there's a saying, don't try to be more Catholic than the Pope. I'll give you an example. A godbrother of mine, Rabindra Sarup, who's a leader in the movement, when he joined the movement, He was in a doctoral program at Temple University. He's getting a PhD in religious studies. And he wrote Prabhupada a letter and said, should I drop out of my program and just, you know, go on Sankirtan? In fact, that's actually what I wrote to Prabhupada. I asked him whether I should stay in school or just go on Sankirtan. I actually asked him specifically about Sankirtan and sell his books. And so Rabindra wrote him the same thing, and Prabhupada wrote back and said, stay in school. I want you to get this degree. And when he showed the letter to the temple leaders, you know what they said? They said, obviously, Prabhupada wants you to drop out of school. And it's obvious that he knows you're attached, and therefore he told you to stay in. I mean, I think these devotees were sincere. They just weren't real bright. On June 22nd, 1975, in Los Angeles, in a room conversation, Prabhupada said that if his disciples, or followers, whatever, could become qualified and teach Krishna consciousness in universities, that would save the world. And he said three times, do it. I want this. So,
well, you know, it's a great general attacks from all different angles in a battle.
Yes.
It doesn't just take one angle.
Exactly.
So, but Prabhupada emphasized book distribution hiring.
To some people.
No, to the whole movement, letter after letter after letter.
He also emphasized to me letter after letter after letter.
That's fantastic. I mean, but.
So I'm doing what Prabhupada asked me to do. I'm carrying out the order of my spiritual master. He said to me, read my books, explain them in your own words. If I can bring people to Prabhupada, then why shouldn't I do it? If we can bring large numbers of people to Krishna and make Krishna, you know, an important, make Prabhupada's mission a cultural force in this country, shouldn't we do it?
Hopefully you can break through, Maharaj.
I hope, well, only
in
if I,
America, because somebody...
only if I get Prabhupada's mercy. Only if I get, but my maybe I should be more clear about this so I don't give the wrong impression. My ultimate concern is not just historical accuracy. I'm not just like a mundane historian, and the whole my whole enthusiasm is just like academic. I mean, in a sense, who cares about all these details, as you said? But the reason I'm trying to do this is because I feel that as Madhvacharya says, quoting one of the acharyas in our line, because one of the great acharyas said, the text is corrupted, that version of the story is preventing people from coming to Krishna. So my goal is to bring people to Prabhupada. I am very, very clear on this point that it's Prabhupada, not myself, that has a potency to take people back to Krishna. I don't pretend that, you know, I'm going to take you back to Krishna. I think I can take you to Prabhupada. And actually, according to the Nectar of Devotion of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it's the great acharyas who really liberate us, and we're serving the acharyas. So you may, I mean, basically what I'm doing, if you go out and you try to give someone Prabhupada's book, I'm trying to get millions of people to accept Prabhupada. And it's just, you know, what's the difference? You give out a little fancy little mantra card, or you give them, a cookie or a flower, or you give them a Mahabharata that they can understand. It's just, you know, it's funny because Giriraj Swami tells this story that when Prabhupada was leaving the world, just before Prabhupada left, in the middle of the night, he called Giriraj to his room. And Giriraj, you know, couldn't imagine what does Prabhupada want. So he ran there and he was sitting in the dark. There was just a candle. Prabhupada called him over and then sort of spoke softly into his ear that when I am gone, will this movement go on? And so Giriraj said sort of the standard answer, as he puts it. Yes, Prabhupada, if we chant and follow the principles and do all these things. And Prabhupada indicated, he said, there also has to be intelligence and management. And so, I think Prabhupada, if we can use our God-given intelligence, Prabhupada once said to me, I mean, me and a few other devotees in his garden in Los Angeles, what is the use of your being Americans if you don't do something wonderful? And Krishna says, I mean, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that our duty comes from our nature. Our duty comes, I mean, Prabhupada himself wanted to retire and write books. And so, I mean, anyway, I'm not anti-book distribution at all. I've sold a lot of books myself. And, but I'm using, I'm doing everything humanly possible for me or spiritually possible for me to try to fulfill Prabhupada's desires. Prabhupada's real desire is that this movement be successful. And so I'm simply doing whatever I can for that. Again, my interest is not academic. My interest is trying to fulfill Prabhupada's desires. Yes.
We always like read the book and we trusted the book, like everything in the book is correct. Now after hearing your lecture, there's a doubt, you know.
Well, it is correct. I mean, spiritually, everything Prabhupada says is perfect, spiritually.
Right, but if things didn't happen the way it said it happened, then how did it happen?
Well, the Bhagavatam, well, again, I'm going by the Bhagavatam. I mean, the basic story, five Pandavas, Krishna, Draupadi, Kunti, it's all there in the Bhagavatam. I'm simply, again, Prabhupada, what I'm saying is, I mean, Prabhupada himself, toward the end of his life, he actually said to the Sanskrit editors that you can do the translation. He didn't even care that much. He said, you do the translations, I want to do the purports. Prabhupada's real concern was to reveal Krishna, to give pure love of Krishna. That was his concern. If he was so concerned about every little detail, why did he just not even translate so many Sanskrit words? Or put in some... In other words, I'm trying to understand how Prabhupada saw the situation himself. I'm not critiquing Prabhupada, I'm trying to understand how he saw things.
I just leave this room thinking like, now I'm not very sure exactly what happened. You know, I think I wanted to know...
We'll read the Bhagavatam.
Okay.
I mean, the Bhagavatam, in many places, the Bhagavatam tells the Mahabharata story.
Right.
It tells a story when, for example, when Arjuna comes back from Dwarka, and he remembers all the pastimes. Bhishma remembers all the stories. And then, I mean, in the 10th canto itself, when Vidura goes on pilgrimage in the 3rd canto, he remembers everything that happened. So the Bhagavatam, on many occasions, tells the story of the Mahabharata. And so the basic story, as we know it, is what happened. I'm only saying that in the text, which again, Madhvacharya, Prabhupada taught me that we are in the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. Prabhupada taught us that. And Madhvacharya, I'm quoting an acharya, it's not my concoction. Madhvacharya said that a lot of these details, not the basic story, the world was overburdened, Krishna came down, he brought his pure devotees. I mean, all these things are right in the Bhagavatam. Krishna lived in Vrindavan, then he went to Mathura, then he went to Dwarka. These things are all in the Bhagavatam. So the basic story is there. And Lord Chaitanya confirmed it, and Prabhupada confirmed it. What I'm talking about is secondary little details, but details are told in a way that makes it hard for this story to really achieve the goal. I mean, that's why Vyasadeva composed it. So there's no question about the basic story. Right. Well, the Bhagavatam says that it talks that we know that Bhishma was on the bed of arrows, and that he was killed by Shikhandi, and so on. So, I mean, the basic story is as we know it. It's just some of the details.
What is the detail?
What is the detail? That Bhishma was shot with arrows. We know that at one point from the Bhagavatam that Krishna picked up a chariot wheel and ran to Bhishma to protect his devotee. And you know, it's interesting because in that story, Bhishma actually taught a very important lesson to Bhishma. Because in terms of, again, I apologize, you know, Prabhupada told me that, it's Prabhupada's order to me. Prabhupada ordered me to present Krishna consciousness in an educated way. That was Prabhupada's first instruction to me. And so in my mind, I'm simply carrying out Prabhupada's order to me. Whatever Prabhupada said to other people, you know, if you were Prabhupada's servant and he said, go cook me a puri, and you said, and then it came time for the puri, so there's no puri, Prabhupada, you know, I decided to go sell a book, he'd be furious. So I have my service to Prabhupada. He personally instructed me. So Bhishma, in terms of moral theory, in terms of general terms used, Bhishma was an act-based moral philosopher or ethicist, in the sense that Bhishma's position, if you look, for example, when he refused to marry Ambika and Ambalika, Bhishma's position was, I don't care about the consequences. He gives a famous speech, let the whole world collapse, I don't care, I'll keep my word. Krishna, that's not Krishna's position. Krishna's position is, the consequences matter. What is the use of acting this way or that way if you just cause a big mess? And so therefore, Krishna was showing Bhishma, and this is described in the Bhagavatam, Krishna was showing Bhishma that to save a pure devotee, I'll do what I have to do. Otherwise, you have that ridiculous scene when Draupadi is being insulted, and Bhishma doesn't say anything. And Prabhupada says in a Bhagavad Gita purport, Prabhupada says Bhishma and Drona lost their respectability as elders because they didn't speak up. So as far as all the details, how Bhishma was killed, I think, you know, basically that Shikhandi killed him. That you know, he had that power. I also think the reason Bhishma wouldn't fight with Shikhandi is because he didn't want to destroy that person's life twice. You know, the excuse is given in the text that, well, because I won't fight with a woman, but he's not a woman, he's a man. I mean, everyone was a woman in a past life, so you couldn't fight with anybody. But in any case, I think basically there was a fight, and Shikhandi was able to do that. Yes.
Thank you for explaining. One of the my co-workers recently showed me a book called The Palace of Thieves. Are you familiar with that? It's a rendition by some Indian author of the Mahabharata, and apparently it's a bestseller. So I was contemplating and thinking that that's, you know, it's the Mahabharata story and it's a bestseller. But I guess the difference with this endeavor is that it'll be the Mahabharata story with, hopefully, from your perspective, a real picture of things.
Yeah, according to the Bhagavatam.
But with the pure devotion message, which will help change hearts rather than the bestseller.
Yeah. Yeah, Prabhupada ordered, for example, Hansa Dutta to write a book. Or he ordered a book. He ordered Sasarupa to write a book. He ordered all this, you know, this devotee scientist to write a book. On many occasions, Prabhupada ordered his disciples to write, and he was very proud of them. It's not to replace Prabhupada's books. It's to, I mean, there's no way in the world we can write books with the same spiritual potency that Prabhupada had. I mean, there's no question of that. Prabhupada's spiritual potency is far beyond anything we can muster. And so, therefore, it's, again, I don't have any delusions that I'm going to, you know, take people back to Godhead or I'm going to save the world. No, not at all. It's Prabhupada that has a purity and Prabhupada who has love of Krishna. It's Prabhupada that knows Krishna. But in Prabhupada's service, I feel this is the best thing I can do for him. To try to fulfill his desires. To try to make his mission successful. So, we'll have some prasadam. Last question, yes?
Thank you for a wonderful, you know, clarification on the Mahabharata. It's so unnerving, but it was so enlightening too. I never heard something like this, because we were born and brought up around Itihasas and Puranas, and we used to go to the movies, and they show all the things you told right in front of our eyes.
but as you said, sometimes we need to be critical ourselves, because a lot of people, when we talk about spiritual matters, they always try to critique you back and say, oh, why did God fight and why did he want to fight and show you all these things? The first question when you talk about Mahabharata, anybody will ask you is like, why did God fight?
My answer to that is very quickly. Is that what would you do? Let's say patriotic Indians or in America, if there was a, let's say someone took over the government and suspended the Constitution. I mean, wouldn't you think it was right to fight to restore constitutional government? Huh? So in the same way, that's what happened. You have to understand that in ancient India there was constitutional monarchy. First of all, people had freedom. There was freedom of speech. We find in the